Okay, ready to ramble. I'm not going to try to summarise the journey we've been on for the last 2 days, otherwise I won't proceed any further today. So for those of you who are here for the first time, you better run to catch up. Although, of course, I can't avoid some sort of preamble, otherwise I don't know how to get going. So, yes, we're looking at this dichotomy between God and atheism. But we've passed really beyond discussion of those particular terms. We've been looking at things in terms of the dichotomy that the Buddha identified between eternalism and nihilism. And really, the Buddha radically rejected metaphysical speculation. So he considered that discussions about the ultimate nature of things in terms of grand ideas like existence and non-existence completely missed the point. There you are, that's it. He considered that between these two extreme ways of interpreting our experience and interpreting it from the grand point of view lay a middle way. And that middle way was based upon a direct experience of one thing arising out of another. The out of is perhaps not quite the right word, independence upon another. You could even say one thing emerging from another, so that the flower emerges from the plant from the seed, and so on. And we've just seen in our own meditation the way in which our present experience, our present mental experience, emerges from preceding conditions, some of which are to do with our actions. So the Buddha said that anything that we can consider, anything that we can make an object of consideration, anything that arises independence on previous conditions. That's the most we can say. We can't absolutize that. We can't say, in a sense, why. A little bit Humean in a way. We can't say that there's some force that's making it happen. Simply observe this, then that. But when we do observe these conditioned arisings, we notice that they conform to certain patterns. And those patterns make it possible for us to predict what will emerge from a given set of conditions. And this, of course, is the stuff of science. So that we can observe that the stone falls to the floor, and we can then postulate the description of that in terms of gravity. It's no more than a description. It doesn't explain it at all. As somebody described it as a sophisticated statement of ignorance. But it does mean that we're able to broadly predict that under certain conditions, certain things will happen. So we can observe that in the world of material things. We can observe it in the world of physics, if you see what I mean. We can observe these regularities there, which have enabled us to build places like this and even more. We can observe it in the world of organic matter. We can observe biological regularities where certain sets of conditions within the biological world lead to certain things emerging. We can observe it in the world of perceptual awareness. When I say perceptual awareness, I don't mean full-blown human consciousness, but the kind of consciousness that perhaps animals have. Well, that animals have. So that there are, laws of stimulus response, laws of the way in which the the light rays are translated into some sort of inner image and so on. And so that we can observe the laws that govern the zoological world. If perhaps you could even include instinct there, the way in which an eel is born in the Sargasso Sea and finds it up my stream in Snowdonia. I don't know how it happens, but it's according to certain sort of regularities that mean that you can broadly predict from given circumstances what the outcome will be. All of that's very important, of course, for our daily functioning. But the Buddha argues that there are two more kinds of regularity that are much more significant from the point of view of our fulfillment and happiness. Even our pleasure in life, happiness in that sense. But especially our deeper resolution, our resolution of deeper problems, our sense of real fulfillment. He argued that this comes about in accordance with certain regularities. And if you like, you could say that his teaching is about those regularities. He is helping us to understand those regularities so that we can, if you like, exploit them to our own benefit and fulfillment. So the first of those regularities is one which probably most people are familiar with in terms of the words, but they're widely misunderstood. This is the so-called law of karma. I recently gave a talk in Budapest, as one does, and translated, of course. And I talked about this regularity, and at the end I had some questions, and I suddenly realised that in Hungarian culture, there's what you might call the Glenn Hoddle interpretation of karma. Do you remember the terrible, disastrous misinterpretation he made that led to him ceasing to be the whatever he was of British football? I'm not very up in these things. I can tell you about karma, but not about football. Yes, he'd said that people were disabled because of their karma. That is not what the teaching is about. It's not about fate or anything like that. And it's most directly experienced in, for most of us, our most direct illustration of it will be in meditation practice. Probably everybody here, or at least most people here, have done some meditation practice. And you'll know that when you sit and try to cultivate metta, loving kindness, you'll know that it's sometimes quite difficult. But you'll also know that it does change your experience. Maybe not immediately, maybe not even in the session. But you probably will have experienced trying to think, may they be well, may they be happy, may they progress. And later, actually feeling that. Seeing that, well, you really do want people's well-being. You've changed the to a small extent at least, the structure of your mind. It's emerged in a different way. You'll experience this most dramatically in a context such as a retreat, advertisement for the LBC's winter retreat. If you go on retreat and you do quite a bit of meditation in a very favourable circumstances, you can really feel very, very different. I remember that my own first retreat. I could hardly remember what I'd felt like before. I just felt so happy, so contented, so much in tune with people, so clear about what I was doing. That wasn't how I felt before. It was a time of some confusion. Well, I was a young student. Enough said. Through practicing meditation in that sort of context with friends around you, there's a definite change in your own mind because you're systematically trying to cultivate, put it rather simplistically, good intentions, skillful thoughts, skillful feelings even. You become different. you are effectively a different person. If you cultivate skillful mental states, skillful in Buddhism being defined as states of mind that are underlain by friendliness, by love, by generosity, by open-heartedness, and by awareness, understanding. If you're cultivating states of mind that are characterized by those, that you yourself will be different. Your deliberate effort to bring those mental states into being changes you. You know, if you engage in systematic practice of this kind over a relatively short time, I can guarantee money back that you will experience a radical change in the very way in which the world appears to you. Of course, everything will be the same shape and so on, but you'll even have a sense, maybe, of things being brighter, being sharper, being clearer, having less of a sense of separation from things, more in tune with things, a deeper capacity for empathy, deeper appreciation of the beauty of things, the meaning of things. And this comes about under this principle, this law of karma, that the efforts that you make modify your own mind. It emerges in a different way because, you know, according to Buddhism, the mind is not a single thing. We use this word mind. It sounds like it's a little box that's sitting in here. That's the sort of one thing that things pass into and out of. But actually, consciousness, mental processes are constantly changing. They're an unending flow of dependently arising states. So we can modify that flow of dependently arising states by deliberately, willfully, that is volitionally, cultivating skillful states, skillful thoughts, skillful speech, skillful action. That's the first principle that the Buddha's teaching is based upon, the deliberate cultivation through an act of volition of states of mind, states of intention, that will modify you. So you are an increasingly flexible, open, sensitive, empathetic, appreciative, and even intelligent being. So the Buddha argued that this process, if you pursue it with sufficient sort of assiduity, will eventually lead to the point at which you recognize that the underlying structure of consciousness up until this point is false. Because consciousness, in our cases, in most people's cases, is based around the idea of a fixed self, a self-identity that somehow stands outside the business of perceiving, the business of thinking, the business of feeling, and that somehow sort of owns or directs it. A hypothetical metaphysical self that is the subject of our experience. But as your experience becomes more flexible, more open, more fluid, it's increasingly easy to see that this is just a thought. It's just an idea. It has no reference to anything that you can ever know. It's a useful, you know, for evolutionary purposes, a useful construction, which enables us to exercise our volition. Without that idea, you couldn't practice according to karma. You'd be just a bundle of instincts that would just drive you, you know, from one bone to another, whatever. Because you have this underlying assumption that there is a real I that's fixed and that can sort of direct, you can begin to discipline your mind. You can discipline, you can choose this direction rather than that. you can go to this class rather than that one. You can come to the LBC rather than not coming to the LBC, a very wise choice. Sometimes, often, usually. Always, sorry, the chairman is just grabbing me and I'm not due to leave yet. Because we identify ourselves, we have the idea of making decisions. It's quite interesting when you start to investigate this business of making decisions. I might have talked about this before, but I some years ago did a long solitary retreat. I was 5 months on my own. And for some reason, the business of decision making became sort of problematic for me. You know the feeling. But in a rather interesting way, I sort of began to be really unclear of where decisions came from. And I found a particularly difficult decision was how to get up in the morning. What is it that you know, what button do you press to get yourself up in the morning? After all, there's nothing to do. I'm on my own. I haven't seen anybody for a long time. Nobody knows if I just spend the whole day in bed. So why get up? And what sort of, you know, what levers come into operation to get me up? And I think it was about 1 o'clock that I found myself in the toilet having a pee. It seemed as good a reason as any. But I didn't even decide. I just did it. So sorry to let you into my secrets, but I find it really interesting just recognizing this apparently simple business of making a decision is actually quite complex and depends upon quite a bit of assumption. So the Buddha argues that a point comes where, especially if you're guided by certain reflections, where that construction of an I as something real and fixed just breaks down. It just won't work anymore. It's sort of there because it's part of the mechanism of the mind. We're kind of, it's bred into us, it's built into us, just as the eye is, and the eye sees a world out there and a seer in here. That's constructed. It's not, I mean, it's constructed into us organically. So you can't get rid of that. It's not that suddenly the Buddha sees everything from every perspective at once. That would just be possible. But we realize that that's a sort of a conditioned relative construction, a way of ordering our experiences that has great utility for breakfast and getting up in the morning and all those sort of things, getting to the LBC, and also for directing one's life to greater fulfillment and happiness. But that has no ultimate metaphysical validity. There is no fixed self. And in Buddhist practice, we deliberately cultivate that insight. We deliberately reflect on the impossibility of there being anything that could be experienced which is fixed, stable I. So our karmic work leads to the mind, the consciousness arising in more and more flexible, fluid ways, which less and less seem to be based upon the idea of a fixed self, where that idea of a fixed self becomes more and more obviously an idea. You're still able to say, hello, I am Subhuti, but you don't sort of think of that as referring to something that has a kind of ultimate reality to it. When you reach a point in karmic development, the Buddha argues, a whole new set of conditions come into play. When you decisively break through that configuration of consciousness around a fixed self, a whole new set of mental states start to progress. They begin to arise independent of volitional activity. These arise in accordance with this last kind of conditionality, this last kind of regularity, which is called the dharmic kind of regularity, the dharma niyama, the dharma law. So it's a law of conditioned arising that is not volitionally based, but in which mental states arise that, in a certain sense, are not yours. That's your experience. Obviously, these mental states become almost impossible to talk about because they're not anybody else's either. If you see what I mean, we've only got those two categories of being in control of our experience and being out of control of our experience. But there's a sort of third category where mental states arise that are not in opposition to you, to your selfhood, but they're not determined by your selfhood. And Buddhism's quite content to leave it at that and not to start speculating about where they come from and who made them and why. They are simply part of the way things are. These mental states which are increasingly free from self-orientation arise spontaneously within you once you've achieved a certain degree of karmic preparation, once you've built for yourself a flexible, fluid mental functioning in which you've been able to recognize the constructed nature of selfhood. These mental states arise quite naturally, spontaneously. At a certain point, they become irreversible. What's said is that you enter the stream of the Dharma. The stream of the Dharma is these kinds of mental state arising within you without any let or hindrance. They simply arise one out of another. And each gives rise to a mental state that is less self-based than the preceding one. And it's this entry into the stream that is the goal and end of Buddhist practice. Once it's taken place, you don't have to bother. The rest will take care of itself. The processes will unfold of themselves within you with your willing acquiescence, so to speak, and you may even be able, with a little bit of volitional effort, to accelerate the process. But you won't be able to stop it. At a certain point, it takes place. Not that you would ever want to stop it, because the experience is one of deepening fulfillment and of a deep sense of the resolution of the fundamental contradictions that are sort of built into self-based consciousness. You know, as a self, as a consciousness that's based around self, there's an inherent sense of discord. Even if you're relatively happy, even if you're relatively ahead of the game, there's a sense underneath it all that it doesn't quite work, that it doesn't quite match up. An unease, a dis-ease. But with the entry into the stream, you feel increasingly at peace, increasingly in harmony. Because you've let go of self-clinging, you don't feel any opposition anymore. Of course, you don't, you know, the letting go is quite a long process, but the battle has been won, even if the mopping up operations still need to continue, to use an inappropriate metaphor. So, you know, the process of finally sort of extirpating the self-orientation continues for some time. But you can't reverse it. You don't want to reverse it. So there's less and less sense of tension, less and less sense of opposition, increasing sense of rightness. Not that you think everything's all right, because plainly things are not all right. But in yourself, you feel all right. An incapacity to act harmfully. It's said that in someone who's entered the stream, the feelings to act harmfully may arise, and even sometimes they may jump out your mouth. But immediately you know what you've done. immediately you apologise, confess, because you've breached the sort of the fundamental character of your experience, if you see what I mean. But you haven't yet completely got rid of all the habits that are associated with self-orientation. So these states of mind process in ever-increasing profundity and clarity and purity. You could say they process indefinitely, because the idea of any conclusion to them, in a sense, has no meaning. This is, yes, the goal and purpose of the Buddhist life. So it's quite important for us to have some sense of this. We can get immediately, every one of us can have some experience of karmic processes. If you just observe yourself on retreat or in meditation or even just in kindly acts or intelligent choices and so forth, you can see the results of karma. You can see them in a modification in your own mind. But these trans-egoic states are ones of which we often have some intuition, but we don't have much, we can't sort of stabilise them. They may arise for us quite spontaneously, apparently spontaneously. Of course, nothing is really spontaneous. Conditions are built up and they arise. But they may arise apparently spontaneously for us, but we're not able to stabilise them and to let them, as it were, take us over yet. So it's important that we get at least some greater idea of what those states are like, so that we can have some relationship to them. Somebody was talking yesterday about something that you draw, well, sort of comfort, reassurance, a sense of meaning and purpose from. Well, for Buddhism, it's drawn from the existence of these trans-egoic states. The fact that it's possible to go beyond all the conflicts of our lives and experience something that is within our grasp, should we simply build up the right conditions. So I want to spend a little bit of time trying to evoke, as best I can, what those states are like, or at least how we could relate to them. Because in Buddhist practice, you could say that we approach things from two points of view. The fundamental one is karma, exercising karma, so that our minds become more and more flexible, so that we have a greater and greater capacity to see things as they are. But step by step with that, we need to be opening up to something that goes beyond that. So we need some relationship to the trans-egoic, what goes beyond our normal mode of perceiving and knowing. We need some relationship to that that can inspire us, can give us some sense of hope. My goodness, don't we need it in this world? Some hope that there's something more. As usual, immediately flashes into my mind a bit of Tarkovsky and Stalker. If you haven't seen it, see it. And it's all about the need for hope, the need for something that goes beyond the ordinary, the egoic. If we don't have that, it's all not worth it, I can tell you. And you can tell yourself too. So we need some definite sense of that, and a sense that's not merely, as it were, blind belief, but a sense that's felt, that you can definitely feel some connection with it, because it's not that far away, and we even have moments of experience of it. So let me just try to evoke this. And I'm going to do it under three classic Buddhist headings: Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha are the three fundamental principles of Buddhism. They're what make you a Buddhist, the fact that you, in the traditional words, classic words, go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, is what makes you a Buddhist. And go for refuge means that you accept them as realities that you are going to make central to your life. So there's something that you need to have some definite relationship to. So these under these three headings, I'm going to talk about, as best I can, what this trans-egoic experience is like and how we can relate to it, as best I can, venturing into new territory for myself, so not quite sure what's going to come out of my mouth. Maybe I require some help from another source. So let's look first of all at the Buddha as a sort of exemplification, embodiment of those trans-egoic mental states. Of course, first of all, he is an embodiment of it, according to Buddhist belief, insofar as he did actually achieve that. Insofar as he transcended ego clinging, he recognized very directly the limitations of a self-based construction of consciousness. He is the perfect embodiment of that state, of those states, because they're not fixed. It's not as if you enter that state and there's a kind of transcendental retirement home. There's a continuing progression of more and more exalted states of mind, which are beyond ego, more and more beyond ego clinging. So the Buddha really embodies that process for us, because it's through him that we, at least as Buddhists, know of that. And he taught us what we need to do to achieve what he achieved. So his embodiment of that trans-egoic state, what we are trying to become and what we're drawing strength from in himself. But it's more sort of direct and experiential than that, at least for some people. Different people approach this in such different ways. But quite a lot of people build a relationship with what goes beyond ego clinging that is, if you like, personal. They feel in a sort of personal connection, maybe with the Buddha. You could say it's imagination, you can say what you like, but their experience is of the Buddha being a kind of presence in their lives, so that they're able to draw strength from him, draw a sense of a peak purpose from him, because they can feel a direct connection with him. And here we're not talking the world of fact, we're talking the world of poetry, which is of course much more real than the world of fact. We're talking the world of imagination, much more real than the world of the ordinary senses. So many people, and especially in the traditional Buddhist world, will feel that either through the figure of the Buddha, or through various figures that have emerged as embodiments of his enlightenment, that they are in direct contact with what goes beyond self-clinging. They won't see it as they won't see this personality as a creator, by far from it. They won't see this personality as something that can solve their mundane problems. But they'll see it as what gives their lives meaning and purpose, and that they feel a real connection with. I sometimes experience things in this way, but it's not my predominant mode personally. But I know many, many friends who do experience very definitely a sense of a personal connection with the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas as consciousnesses that are sort of within them in a certain sense, but beyond them in a certain sense. It's very hard to really get clear because, of course, usually our experiences of a consciousness outside ours, like your consciousness, are broadly speaking outside my consciousness. Well, when I say broadly speaking, they are. So usually we mean that. Your consciousness is really out there independent of mine, so to speak, apparently, if you don't look at it all too closely. But you can have an experience of a consciousness that is not exactly not yours, but that doesn't feel like yours. I remember a very powerful experience that Sangharaksha describes when he was 16 in Tooting. Believe it. We North Londoners, how can we believe that anything good can come out of South London? He was an avid reader, and he used to, as a lad, go to Tooting Public Library. Yes, there used to be public libraries in the world. And he said that he used to often do a lot of thinking when he was walking. And one day he became sort of fascinated at the age of, I think, 15, not 16 even yet. He became fascinated by the way in which consciousness is located. There's my consciousness and your consciousness, and I don't have access to your consciousness, and you probably don't have access to mine. And he sort of thought, why? Why is consciousness located here rather than there? And at that point, he said, he experienced suddenly a consciousness that was, as it were, infinite, and within which all consciousness was contained, and which it appeared as if he was walking through it. And that's the nearest he could get to describing it. But an experience that you drop this very a consciousness very focused on this organism attached to this I, and there's just consciousness. And insofar as you're still quite eye-bound, it appears to be not yours. Actually, it's neither yours nor not yours, if you see what I mean. It's not somebody else's. It's just that it's not to be perceived in terms of that kind of bifurcation. So this sort of experience you can even cultivate. And some Buddhist practice aims at developing a strong sense of a connection with the Buddha's consciousness, you could say, with the Buddha's mind. In a certain sense, you know it's not the Buddha's mind. You don't think that the Buddha in Magadha 2,500 years ago is sending thought waves to you now. It's not literalized like that. But the experience that you have, the best way you can think of it is that you're in contact with the Buddha's mind, or the mind of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who in later tradition came to embody for others that sort of experience. You may not even give it a name. It may simply strike you in the way that Sangharakshita describes as just a vast consciousness in which your consciousness is, as it were, a tiny part. But we deliberately cultivate a connection with that, if we can. And we experience that consciousness as completely unbiased. It has no interest, as it were, in the sense of personal interest. It's impartial. It's completely objective. Just sees. At the same time, completely accepting of everything. It feels no difference from everything around. At the same time, sees things absolutely as they are. And at the same time, it sort of knows what to do. Out of it, that the action just spontaneously flows. And in that sort of state, well, that's what Sangharakshita described, I think, as I mentioned yesterday, feeling like an impersonal force. So that you do what needs to be done without any sense of, I'm doing it. It just happens. Just emerges out of this sense of the situation and what needs to be done. It just happens. A completely unwilled, unstrained way. May it come. So yes, we have that sense of the Buddha. This, of course, the Buddha full of compassion, but not compassion in the sentimental sense or the suffering sense. Compassion simply in the sense of seeing needs and fulfilling them, not being able to ignore the situation around, not being able to cut off from it, being directly aware of it and responding to it. So that's the way in which we try to relate to this this suprapersonal, this non-egoic state of consciousness that we ourselves have access to. We have access to it, first of all, immediately, through the medium of our imaginations, of our ability to poetically evoke. But eventually we can have access to it by direct experience. It may burst upon us well before we've entered the stream. We may have moments of experiencing like that. That's what I think Sangharakshita is talking about in his experience in Tooting, at Amen Corner, of all wonderful places. So that's perhaps the kind of most common way in which Buddhists will tend to think about, or rather relate to, that suprapersonal state of mind or consciousness that they themselves can have direct access to. That's why we have a Buddha image. We have that image because the image embodies that state of ego transcendence, that state of a consciousness that is not referring back to I. That's what the image represents. And it represents also the goal of our own spiritual lives, our own dhammic lives. So the experience of that trans-egoic state of mind can be mediated to us through the imaginative experience of a personhood. It can be mediated to us in more, I was going to say abstract, but it's not really abstract. Difficult to say what the right word would be. In Indian religion, you get this distinction between in modern Hindi, shagun and nirgun, without qualities and with qualities, or with personality, without personality. You don't have anything quite like that in Buddhism, but it does get at something. So that you can have an experience of, for instance, love, just pure love, which is experienced as not love from something to something else. You know, when we do the metta, the metta bhavana, we're consciously trying from our own self-love, as it were, to extend that to others. So it's a jolly good thing, but it's still ego-based. Mm-hmm. Through our own a sense of our own dislike of pain and love of pleasure, we want others to have that, so that we imaginatively extend into the lives of others, but from ourselves. This is important. This is what the practice is initially about. It's a karmic practice, if you like. You're consciously developing those mental states because they will produce a state of mind which eventually can burst free from that. So that in the Maitri Bhavana, particularly in the fifth stage, you're sort of being invited to go beyond your self-identification. You're being invited to enter into an experience of metta, of Maitri, of love, let's not put too fine a point upon it, not shilly-shally, of love that is completely without self-interest, and that is all-embracing, all-encompassing, is without distinctions, That's why in the fifth stage of the Maitri Bhavana, you deliberately take yourself, friend, neutral person, enemy, and you equalize the emotion towards each. Because you're trying to get beyond the partiality, which is the basis for your experience of it, so that you can experience a Maitri that is trans-egoic. So that you just feel love that's got no self-reference at all, or at least less and less self-reference, or in which the self-reference is a tiny little shudder somewhere in the background, a willing shudder. So it could be that you experience it like that, as an overwhelming sense of love. It could be that you experience it as a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of rightness, nothing to do, nowhere to go. I remember this being very, very important for me on my long solitary retreat, because, I put myself in a position where I was faced with all my previous karma, and I experienced a lot of disturbance. And I read a passage in which Sangharakshita describes his first sight of one of his teachers, Dujom Rinpoche, who's a very important 20th century Tibetan guru of the Nyingma school. And he describes being invited. He was a bhikshu, Sangharakshita was a monk. He was invited to a ceremony that Dujom Rinpoche was performing. And in that ceremony, he was blessing the ground on which a temple was to be built. And apparently he, it's a traditional Tibetan rite in which he, said certain mantras and so forth and did certain rituals, and that prepared the ground for the cutting of the ground and the building of the temple. And Sangharakshita describes how, first of all, he saw this rather small figure in a Tibetan burqa. He apparently was already quite an impressive figure, although quite small. There was a strong presence to him. And at a certain point, Sangharakshita describes him as standing absolutely still. And he had the impression, he says, that it wasn't just a stillness of the body. It was a stillness of the mind. It was a stillness like the stillness of the depths of the ocean. And he described it as the stillness of a mind that was completely, absolutely at peace with itself and at peace with the world. And I thought, I want some of that. I want some of that. Just as a footnote to this, apparently Sangharakshita was told later that the workers, when they'd come to dig, found not a single worm or insect in the ground. I leave it to you to make what you like of that. Apparently part of the ceremony was inviting them to shift home. Anyway, you may experience that trans-egoic state as a state of complete peace. And I must say, I did begin towards the end of my retreat to just feel, there's nothing to do, nowhere to go. It's all here. Everything's complete. There's nothing to be achieved, nothing to bother about, nothing to worry about. It's all here. So you may experience it like that, and perhaps we could put all this under the heading of Dharma. Or you may experience it as a deep recognition of the truth, not as a set of philosophical postulates floating through your mind, as a direct perception. You just look and you see the truth. It's a direct, intuitive, if you like, perception of the truth of things, of the reality of things. You might use words to explain that, but the words are not the experience. The experience is absolutely direct, absolutely complete, and the words always have a habit of falling into the possibility of misunderstanding. Sometimes it's said you can't You can't speak the truth. You can never speak the complete truth. I rather think that you can speak the complete truth, but you can't avoid being misunderstood, if you see what I mean, or the possibility of being misunderstood. So this is dharma. Dharma is the fundamental truth of things. The original meaning of dharma comes from a root dhr early Sanskrit, or pre-Sanskrit Sanskrit, let's say. And it means to hold, in the sense of uphold. So dharma, in its very most basic meaning, is what upholds the universe, you could say, what upholds reality. It's the principle of cosmic order, it's been described. Already, when you say those words, you horrifyingly misunderstand. Dharma is this direct perception of the way things are, which transcends words, which words are only an attempt to communicate to those who've got ears to hear. So you may experience at least sort of, as I say, abstract is the wrong word, but these, in terms of principles, love, peace, truth, whatever. Harmony, a very important experience, harmony. Realizing where fundamental harmony lies. Very interesting, I think this is what Dr. Ambedkar meant when he said that he derived the principles of liberty, equality and fraternity, which were his idea of the true and just society, derived them not from the French Revolution, thank goodness, but from his master, the Buddha. In other words, he derived them from the Dharma, from the way things really are. The third way is, of course, Sangha. I'm going to say more about this on Sunday, if I can work out what I'm going to say. In the experience of Sangha, you experience this trans-egoic state through your participation in community, in an inspired community, not any old community, not just group solidarity. It's not football match self-transcendence, if you see what I mean. Sorry, I know there are football fanatics here, but it's not to do with suddenly feeling that you're participating in a group mood or something like that. Something to do with being completely an individual, but completely in tune with a number of others, where you sense that there's a spirit abroad that people completely share in as individuals, and which you can identify yourself with. You can experience that on different levels, but the true experience of Sangha is this experience of coming into contact with something that is beyond selfhood, that is shared by a community of people, a community in the sense of a number of people coming into a vivid enough interaction with each other. It's what really we are striving to create in our Tri Ratna Buddhist community in order. We're striving to create this sort of sangha. And from time to time, we achieve it. From time to time, something does sort of flower amongst us that you can't say anybody in particular is responsible for, but something to do with the interaction of everybody. And out of it comes something that's, well, this is all metaphor, is more than anybody in particular, that sort of arises out of the interaction that everybody has, and that is intensely satisfying, and a deep sense of relief. The whole issue of community is a very, very vexed one for us. It's really complex interacting with other people. I'm sure you all know. Particularly people en masse. It's I can think right the way through my life how problematic it is, how to get into a relationship with others which in which you're yourself, and at the same time you're in tune. It's really, really problematic. But the ideal of Sangha, the experience of Sangha, is the experience of that sort of attunement in which everybody's able to be completely themselves. Nobody's given themselves up in the sense of losing their self-identity in the shallow sense. But everybody's in tune with everybody else. And something sort of more emerges amongst you, often only for a little while. Something happens. I particularly notice it in the context of our order gatherings, perhaps in a puja or a meditation or even sometimes a talk. Something emerges which draws everybody beyond themselves without them losing themselves. And it hovers there for a few brief moments and then scattered. And a whole effort is to try to bring that about. So these three modes are the ways in which we, as Buddhist practitioners, try to relate to the trans-egoic, what goes beyond our own ego identity. We try to come into some relationship to that so that we are spurred on and even lifted up beyond ourselves, so that we've got some sense of hope, some sense of a purpose, some sense of direction. We try to come into as vivid a relationship with that through Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And different people, according to character, will find one or other of those, and perhaps there are more ways of putting it too, more or less appealing. But we need to have some strong sense of what goes beyond us as mere individuals and as mere ego identities, as mere volitionally directed individuals. And we need to build that into our lives so that our lives are lived in relationship to it. And this is what I'm arguing lies between the death of God and the hell of atheism. There's some genuine connection with what lies in this line of empirical processes of conditioned arising, so that you have the courage, the confidence, the reassurance to keep going, because it's not easy. And I think that probably is enough, because it's 7 o'clock. I was going to leave time for questions, but I think I've probably covered some very, very important material that could really warrant further discussion, but unfortunately not today. But I hope this has been useful, and I hope that you do feel like I do, that Nietzsche didn't live in vain. He's alerted us to the dangers of our times, and that he misunderstood Buddhism, and that if he'd really had the chance to understand Buddhism, he probably would have found something that was more to his taste. And it might have meant that he didn't have to go round the twist. I personally believe we need to emphasise this dimension of Buddhism much more strongly. Otherwise, I think the great danger is that we do end up with Nietzsche's terror of a Western Buddhism, in the sense of a nihilistic Buddhism. So I hope that I've stimulated at least further inquiry and exploration and discussion around this issue. Thank you.